Roughly Speaking with Dan Rodericks is brought to you by The Ivy Bookshop, an independent bookstore at Falls Road and Lake Avenue in Baltimore. The Ivy stocks a wide selection of books covering Baltimore and the Chesapeake Bay region, many by local authors. Located at 6080 Falls Road, more information can be found at theivybookshop.com or by calling 410-377-2966.
I'm Dan Rodericks, and this is Roughly Speaking from the Baltimore Sun, episode 407 for the 18th day of July, 2018. Today, we offer a fascinating look back to Baltimore before the Civil War and the lives of the free blacks who resided in the city and across Maryland, a state full of the tensions that led to the war between North and South. In the first half of the 19th century, Maryland was a slave state, though the level of slavery turned on what part of Maryland you were talking about. At the time, there were thousands of free black people, either freed slaves or those born free. In fact, Baltimore was home to the nation's largest free black community. There were 25,000 of them here by the 1830s. The city was a crossroads of commerce, culture, and politics, and according to our guest today, it became a crucible for the question of the rights of free people of color.
It's still important for us to appreciate that there is something fundamental about the rule of law that it must extend even to free people of color, even to people who some say are not citizens.
Martha Jones, a legal historian based at Johns Hopkins University after several years at the University of Michigan, has researched the lives of free blacks in antebellum Baltimore, and she learned a lot about them. She learned that while free, they feared being kidnapped to slavery. That while free, their freedom was restricted by so-called black laws that limited where they could go and what work they could do. That while free, they could not vote in elections. That while free, many of them feared that they would be forced out of the country, deported to Africa. Maryland, after all, had embraced colonization, and the Maryland State Colonization Society had established an independent state in West Africa, later annexed by Liberia, to relocate African Americans there. But in the midst of all this, what Martha Jones learned from old records preserved in the Maryland State Archives was that free blacks learned how to assert their limited rights. They learned that the city courthouse was the place to go for help in legal matters, from contract disputes to permits for travel and gun ownership. They hired white attorneys to represent them. They found judges who listened to their grievances. If they did not achieve equality, Martha Jones says, they at least gained some parity with whites in the courthouse. They learned, in small steps, what it means to be a citizen. Martha Jones's scholarship builds on a pamphlet written in 1838 by a man named William Yates. It was entitled, The Rights of Colored Men to Suffrage, Citizenship, and Trial by Jury. Yates's writing represented the first argument that free blacks should enjoy the fundamental rights of citizenship. 180 years later, Martha Jones has produced a rich history of race and rights in the years before the Civil War, and right here in the crucible that was Baltimore at the time. Her book is Birthright Citizens, published in June by Cambridge University Press. What's interesting to me about your book is, you know, I've been in Baltimore for 40-something years now, and I've been fascinated by the period of the Civil War in Baltimore, but also in the years before that and what it was like to be a free black in Baltimore. I got some insight on that from Matt Crenson's book last year, his political history of Baltimore, but even more so from yours. And it looks like this to me, that the free blacks in Baltimore lived at this crossroads. You describe it as a crossroads of culture, commerce, and politics. There's so much going on. You look south to slavery, and you're still worried about maybe ending up there. You look north to what looks like freedom for you, but you live in Baltimore or Maryland, and while you're free, you're really not that free. You're restricted from, you know, where you can work or whether you can go to school or own property, and you can't vote, and yet the courthouse is open to you. And there's a lot of talk in your community, probably at your church, about claiming your rights as citizens because you were born free. You just live in this very restricted place called Maryland, and specifically Baltimore. Was that a good and fairly accurate general description of what it was like to be a free black?
It's a great description. And honing in on the courthouse, as it turns out to be, perhaps for many people, an unexpected place where free people of color are turning up and really pushing on the kinds of boundaries, the kinds of restrictions that are formally in place, but of course in the day-to-day and kind of really intimate face-to-face interactions of a courthouse, it turns out it's really possible for people to make the most of that. And it helps us understand why people stay in Baltimore, even as they see the possibility of, say, Philadelphia or Pittsburgh. They don't seize that. They stay here, and instead they go to the local courthouse.
Because they've learned from others that there is redress, that there is a place where you can go and be heard.
Yep.
How did they get that information? Am I right? Did it come from churches? Did it come from the churches starting schools?
I think it begins with the circulation of newspapers as far back as the 1820s. So Freedom's Journal is the first African-American newspaper in the U.S. It's published out of New York, but it has two agents in Baltimore from the start. And so we imagine the ways in which, we don't have to imagine, the ways in which that newspaper, which is writing very expressly about the state of slavery, certainly, but also the state of free African American life, that is circulating. And it's fascinating because one of the agents, at least, is a man who himself cannot read or write. And so then we remember that people are reading aloud to one another, right? They're sharing news orally as it comes to them. So the newspaper, I think, is an important, if you will, primer in what law is, what the Constitution is, what rights are, and how folks might look to redress their day-to-day grievances in a place like the local courthouse.
But you might know that. It's another thing to actually become active and to say, all right, I'm going down to the courthouse because there's a job I want and I'm being told I can't have that job. Or there's something, I want to own a house and I'm told I can't own this house, or something like that.
So people are oddly, if you will, drawn into the courthouse by some of these what we call black laws, these draconian state statutes that have placed all kinds of restrictions on free people of color. Their labor is restricted, their associational life, their church life, all subject to regulation by the state. And as a consequence, if you want to do certain things like travel away from Maryland and come back, you have to go into the local courthouse. So part of what I was able to do in Birthright Citizens was go back to the records of those sort of everyday transactions in the courthouse to figure out what's happening. And what happens is that people do come in. In the case of travel permits, you have to have three respectable white persons who will vouch for you, in essence. Well, they do. And then what we see is people successfully coming out of the courthouse with travel permits signed by state judges in the local courthouse that give them a kind of somewhat ephemeral, but a real right to travel in and out of the state.
Okay, so there, that's not a challenge to the law. That's just, hey, that's what the law says. Let's go down to the courthouse and take advantage of it.
I think so. But oftentimes, I think these transactions are understood as a one-way transaction, which is to say there is a kind of denigration, right? White Baltimoreans don't have to come to the courthouse and get a permit when they want to travel, and black Baltimoreans do. And that is a race line in the city during this period. But at the same time, I would argue, and I think it's true, that these are folks who feel empowered, right, and have mobilized whites who are allies, I'm going to put that in quotes, but whites who are allies who have managed to persuade a judge that they are someone who should be permitted to re-enter the state. And so I think there's two ways of looking at it. And you're right, it's an everyday sort of transaction. But these are the kinds of things that local folks are then seeing one another do, right? So how do you learn about the courthouse? Well, it's partly because your neighbor did it.
Mm-hmm,
right. And
right.
We have a few examples, right, of neighbors even coming in together, for example, to get gun permits. And they do it together every year. And so there is this informal, I think, network of knowledge that is circulating. It's also important to remember there are lawyers, and there are lawyers in Baltimore City throughout the period before the Civil War who service African-American communities as part of their regular clientele.
These are white lawyers?
White lawyers.
Because
they're
blacks
are only white
lawyers,
right? In this period.
Yeah.
One of the most surprising examples to me was John Latrobe. So John Latrobe, who we associate with his leadership in the colonization movement, but who is an important figure in legal culture in Baltimore. Well, Latrobe's diaries tell us that among his earliest clients were free African Americans. And they were coming in trying to understand, manage day-to-day disputes, and Latrobe represented them. But also, they came to him asking about rights. There was a curfew imposed in Baltimore on African Americans. And a black representative of the local Legal Rights Association comes into Latrobe and says, I'd like to pay you a fee so you can give me an opinion about whether or not this mayor's act is actually constitutional. So lawyers are an important part of this. And rather than rejecting or refusing a black clientele, for many lawyers in Baltimore, particularly new lawyers like Latrobe was, it's part of how one builds a practice in a city like Baltimore. There are so many free African Americans, 25,000 by the eve of the war. This is a real client base. In a city with a robust legal culture and lots of competition, you can represent individual African Americans, you can represent black institutions like churches, and that can become part of your regular practice.
You mentioned colonization. Now, this was another thing that was being talked about a great deal, actually legislated upon, and it's something that free blacks in Maryland would worry about, right?
Absolutely.
It's the push to send them back to Africa.
It's a tremendous pressure in Maryland, probably more so than any place else in the country, because even as colonization gets a mixed reception in many places, Maryland as a state, and as you mentioned, the state legislature even appropriates funds to support colonization, which is a political movement that aims to remove former slaves from the country. It emanates out of a view that there is no future for an interracial democracy. Slavery may end in the colonizationist vision, but African Americans, free African Americans, will never be citizens. So this is a pressure in a place like Maryland. And the story we often tell about colonization is that it was a voluntary movement. It was a movement that worked by way of persuasion. And that was true to an important degree. But in Maryland, you also have a strain of what I wind up calling radical colonization. And these are folks from the 1820s forward who look to pass laws in Annapolis that would force the removal of free people of color. Now, they don't succeed, but not for lack of trying, as we say. There really is a powerful pressure on free people of color here to make their way elsewhere.
Massive deportation.
Well, you know, the folks I write about have watched Indian removal. And so it may, from the 21st century, look like a sort of exaggerated sort of vision. But if you've watched tens of thousands of Native people be forcibly relocated out of the southeastern United States, and you're sitting in a place where colonization is not only in the air, it's in the pocketbooks and on the streets, you think, well, maybe that is possible.
And that's something that continued throughout the Civil War and even after the Civil War, right?
Absolutely. So colonization, there's one more push in 1859 on the eve, what we know now was the eve of the Civil War. The Jacobs Bill would have either removed all free people of color from Maryland, and that's 75,000 people, or would have rendered them all slaves, many of them for the first time. So yes, it continues. And it helps us to appreciate the ways in which I think emancipation, right, the abolition of slavery in Maryland in 1864 is an incomplete gesture, because part of what is troubling for people of color in Maryland is this view that, well, they might be free, but they really can't be 100% participants in the body politic.
So by the time we get to Dred Scott, the Dred Scott decision, of the Supreme Court, 1857, were you able to divine what the reaction to that was among people who were already being very active in the courts, free blacks, and those who supported them in Baltimore? They saw that as just a huge setback for their cause, or was there any local reaction to it?
So there's a great deal of interest in Baltimore in Dred Scott, in part because of the large community of free people of color here, but also because Roger Taney is one of legal culture's favorite sons. So the Baltimore Sun anticipates the decision, warms up the city for finally Taney's release of his opinion, and then covers it extensively. And the Sun celebrates the decision.
As being a final resolution?
Perhaps prematurely, but within 48 hours, 72 hours, the Sun declares Dred Scott to be the definitive determination and to have settled the question of not only slavery, but the status of free people of color going forward. They are not citizens of the United States. So I was interested in this, and one way to test it was to go back to the records of the local courthouse in March of 1857 and see what happened. Was anybody talking about Dred Scott? Did anything change in the local courthouse? And the answer was no. That in fact, free people of color continued to come to the local courthouse and bring their everyday claims just as they had prior to the Dred Scott decision. So that was one important piece. The other piece is that Justice Taney himself follows closely the response to Dred Scott, and I had the opportunity to read his papers, some of which are here at the Maryland Historical Society. And what Taney is aware of is that very few courts are deferring to Dred Scott. They are finding the runaround Dred Scott. They are distinguishing the facts of a given case from Dred Scott. And so free people of color, not only in Baltimore, but in other places, are managing to eke out rights.
Is that because the judiciary was sympathetic, the judges were abolitionists? Can we tell from court rulings or decisions where the judiciary stood on this, who these men were?
We can, and the best example is right here in Maryland, because Maryland's High Court, the Court of Appeals in 1858, hears a case called Hughes versus Jackson. And in that case, Maryland's High Court is confronted with the question, do free people of color have the right to sue in the state courts of Maryland? Now, the logic of Dred Scott would say no, they're not citizens, they're people without rights. But John Carroll LeGrand, who is sits at the head of the Court of Appeals, is a man very much of Taney's generation and of Taney's sensibilities, looks at the facts in the state of Maryland and says, no, thank you, Dred Scott. Free people of color in Maryland are not citizens, but they do enjoy a set of what we would call today civil rights, the right to sue and be sued, to protect their persons and their property, because this is the only way that we can expect people to be productive, earnest workers, to be socially in conformance with our norms, that if people don't have the ability to protect their persons and their property in the courts, we will have 75,000 outlaws in the state of Maryland. And that's not possible in LeGrand's vision. Free people of color are in the state of Maryland. They are here to stay, at least for the moment. And as long as they're here, he says, they have to have the ability to come into court. So this is another blow to Dred Scott right in Justice Taney's backyard.
The Court of Appeals ruling with the Chief Justice LeGrand doesn't go as far as the 14th Amendment went, though.
Not at all.
It doesn't say that that the blacks are equal under the law.
No, and that's very important. Yes. There is no one in Maryland, including LeGrand in this period, who has that kind of radical vision. And you can imagine that how hard that is in a state where anything that even reeks of abolitionism or civil rights is considered seditious. That is not LeGrand's vision, but that means it's still important for us to appreciate that even for someone who is not a racial egalitarian, there is something fundamental about the rule of law that it must extend even to free people of color, even to people who some say are not citizens.
I'm really interested about free blacks going to court for things that we would consider sort of even mundane or simple today. But it is fascinating to think of this in the 1820s and 30s happening. Can you give us another example of why, say, a black family or a black man would go to court?
Sure. I think an example that will resonate with folks today is that of apprenticeship or indenture contracts. So these are legal arrangements by which free people of color, many of whom are impoverished, give the custody of their children over to a white contract holder. The bargain is you can have custody of our child if you will train him or her in a skilled trade, if you will feed and clothe him or her, provide some education until their maturity. And these are hard arrangements to arrive at, but they are very common in the city of Baltimore. And maybe it won't surprise you that they, from time to time, go very wrong, which is to say contract holders do not live up to the promises that they've made, or they are said to have been abusive to young apprentices, or in some cases, apprentices disappear, leave the state, or sent away and out of the literal reach of their parents. What to do if you're a parent and an indenture contract has gone wrong? Well, in Baltimore, you walk into the local courthouse and you work with the clerk and you take out a writ of habeas corpus, the great writ, produce the body. And now free people of color are using the authority of the state to compel white men, contract holders, to come into the courthouse and account for their treatment of children, the whereabouts of children, and their fulfillment of these contracts. And this surprises us, I think, because the writ of habeas corpus and access to the courts does give free people of color the appearance of, if not equality with white contract holders, a kind of parity in this proceeding that permits them to get a kind of accounting.
It's kind of astounding to imagine it. And I'm getting a vision of it as you're speaking of a, you know, a black man or even his family appearing in court, a black man and his wife with a white attorney maybe who's helping them out, seeking redress, a white judge. And over there at the defendant's table is a white landlord or a white craftsman or someone who took someone on as an apprentice. And it's a kind of amazing thing to think about in 1828 or 1830.
It is. And I think that for me, and going through the records of the city courthouse, which are held in Annapolis at the Maryland State Archives, scene after scene after scene, right? Told in very bare bones terms. But you're right to imagine, I think, that kind of intimate confrontation in a courtroom and indeed in public, right? So not a private confrontation, but a public confrontation, one that goes on the official record. And all of that, I think, helps us appreciate the meaning that free people of color give to those encounters. Sometimes they win, sometimes they lose, frankly, and that is important to remember. But I would still say that there is a value and a meaning in the possibility that one can stand up in a courtroom, hold a white person accountable in a world where these kinds of lines, right, of race and status are murky and unfixed. In those snapshots, right, we get a sense of what's possible.
But also to me, it seems like you're describing, my cliche would be building blocks, the road to the 14th Amendment, to the civil rights legislation of the 1960s, you know, more than 100 years later, that it started in the courthouse with a, you know, black free blacks recognizing that they had some rights.
Absolutely. I think that is the story. And sometimes we tell that story beginning with the Civil War and Reconstruction. And that was a story that I knew well. But I had this sense that if there was a Dred Scott case, which is probably the one case in this whole book that will already be familiar to readers, that there was more. And what would happen if we asked about the Dred Scott question in the local courthouse, and you open up those clerk's docket books out of Baltimore City in the 30s, the 40s, the 1850s, and you don't have to hunt long to find free people of color there, some of them coming with some regularity. The courthouse is a familiar place to these folks. And I think this is a new picture for a lot of people who thought the courthouse might be off limits to people of color.
And even after Dred Scott, it continued as if Dred Scott didn't happen.
That is right.
So the black press that you've mentioned before really paid attention to Baltimore. Why is that? Was this a kind of a crucible here?
Absolutely. Yeah. And it's important to remember that Baltimore is a place through which many fugitives and former slaves have passed on their way to places like Philadelphia, New York, and New Haven. The most famous, of course, is Frederick Douglass, but Douglass isn't alone. And so, yes, there is a keen awareness of Baltimore and the special challenges that free people of color face in a slave state. And there is an admiration because as challenging as struggles are in a state like New York or Pennsylvania, and there are challenges for free people of color there, they are nothing like living in a slave state. Being subject to the regulation of a state legislature that is very deliberately looking to sustain slavery and is prepared to regulate free people of color in draconian ways to keep slavery intact and insulated from the contagion that free people of color might represent. So there's admiration and encouragement that comes from the northern states. I'll say there's also sometimes ridicule, right? Because free people of color in Maryland consider a whole range of options that wouldn't occur to a New Yorker. They think a lot about colonization or emigration. They think a lot about leaving. And that's partly because they're in this dynamic port city, but it's because they're in this vice of colonization and black laws and slavery. And so there are moments when New Yorkers, I think, in my view, underappreciate why it is that if you were a free person of color in Maryland, you might actually think about leaving the country altogether.
Because if you're in New York or Albany or Boston, someplace like that, and you're a free black, you don't have these pressures.
You're not hearing about, say,
colonization all the time. Your own legislature is not passing a law to make it possible to send you back to Africa.
No, right? And the struggles in New York and Pennsylvania by the 1820s and 30s are around political rights. Now, it's not going well for free men of color in New York and Pennsylvania. Those states are cutting back, for example, on voting rights for free men of color. So these are not utopias, but you're right. These are not places where people feel themselves literally at risk of being deported. And there is a great deal of admiration for folks who sort of have put down their roots here and are going to stay.
And one point that we actually didn't make is that there's still slavery in Maryland until, what, 1863?
1864.
64,
There's a new state constitution that abolishes slavery. Maryland is not subject to the Emancipation Proclamation in 1863, and so slavery continues here. And so, yes, that is a tremendous pressure, and it's one of the things that makes free people of color pariahs, is that they are said to at least to have the potential to incite the unrest among slaves by their example.
There's one more thing I want to ask you about for the purposes of this podcast. So when I started reading your introduction and I saw the name William Yeats, I said, oh, she's going to quote some poet here in the beginning. I had no idea who William Yeats was. I never heard of his treatise of 1838, The Rights of Colored Men. It's kind of amazing, this document.
It is.
William Yeats is kind of mysterious, isn't he?
Well, it turns out he was pretty mysterious. I was very fortunate to not only read about it, but to have access to a copy of this 1838. It's basically a pamphlet.
Right.
But it is a legal treatise, and it's the only one in the years before the Civil War that exclusively writes about the rights of free people of color.
What they might be.
What they might be. And Yeats is, on the one hand, aiming in this text to do a kind of synthetic, right, thorough treatment of this question on the one hand, but Yeats, as I'm able to discover, is also an abolitionist.
Is he white or black?
Well, that's the question, isn't it?
So that is still a question.
No, it's not today. But I didn't know the answer to that. And I would say to colleagues, do you think Yeats is white or black? It just was unclear. And
well, I thought he was a poet.
And I think, as you probably know, because you've read the introduction to this book, I sort of pull on that thread long enough to discover that the William Yeats who authors this pamphlet is a white man from Albany, New York, or Troy, New York. But there is another William Yeats, a man with the same name, a former slave who purchases his freedom, becomes a janitor at the U.S. Supreme Court, gives himself a kind of legal education in Washington, D.C., and then migrates to San Francisco, where he becomes an activist and leader in that very important community of free people of color. So what you're alluding to is that I myself was confused, and it turns out I'm not the first historian to have been confused about this question.
Because the spelling of the last name is the same, right?
It's exactly right. The same. Mm-hmm. But the story is important because it reminds us that there is the well-known story of white abolitionist activists who are engaged on these questions. And what I hope to do in Birthright Citizens was to recover the story of men like the former slave, William Yeats, who were also sophisticated and sustained activists around these questions, too.
That's another thing that I think amazes me, is the self-education of freed blacks. I mean, some were able to go to school, mm-hmm. but many just learned to read and then read everything they could. And then engaged in these questions. I guess we're under the impression that, you know, that freed slaves, especially free, not if you weren't born free, if you were a freed slave, you were illiterate. You had, you know, no understanding of books and words, and you couldn't read. So it's amazing to me to read about some people and how quickly they progress in their understanding, not just of the world around them, but of the Constitution and their rights as citizens. That's really impressive.
It is. It's important to remember that Maryland is alone among the slaveholding states to permit people of color to be educated. There's no law against that in Maryland. So in Baltimore, we have no public education for children of color, but we do have generally church-sponsored schools. And that is an important piece of this story, that kind of fundamental education then puts folks in a position to read The Sun, to read Freedom's Journal, right, mm-hmm. to read the abolitionist pamphlets like Yeats's Rights of Colored Men, and to teach themselves. They work with lawyers when they need to. And the records tell us, right, they're prepared to come in and pay the fee. You know, what is the fee for your opinion on X, your opinion on Y? And they are bold enough to seek out some pretty important figures like William Wirt, who had been the Attorney General of the United States and then settles in Baltimore. Well, they call on Wirt and they say, we need an opinion about whether or not we're citizens. He doesn't give it, but they tell him they're willing to pay the $50 that he's going to charge. Mm. So they are ingenious in this way, right? They recognize that there is a power in legal knowledge and that no one is going to invite them to read law or to attend law school in the ways that white men are being educated, but that they can indeed use the newspapers, use the tracts and pamphlets, use the abolitionist literature, and use the folks in their immediate vicinity here in Baltimore to help them do that. And I think on balance, they get a real cooperation from the bar here, sometimes for a fee, but that doesn't surprise us. That's lawyers' business, right? But, you know, for $25 or $50, you can get a lawyer to give you an opinion on the question of the day.
Was there something in your research that you didn't anticipate, that you discovered a real discovery or just an eye-opener for you?
Yeah.
Because I assume you had some anticipation of what you would find once you started looking.
I expected that free people of color would be in the courthouse on the receiving end of criminal charges, right? So I expected to find them there. Absolutely. And they are there. I expected to find them in cases involving these black laws. That seemed evident. Where I really didn't expect to find them and found them in important numbers were in something like bankruptcy, insolvency proceedings. Why? Because I don't think I fully appreciated the ways in which free people of color in Baltimore were a regular and very well integrated part of the local everyday economy before the Civil War. And so black men, and it's mostly black men, are on the streets and in the alleys and in the shops in Baltimore. They're on the wharf and in the harbor. And they're making contracts every day, verbal, oral, you know, ephemeral, but they are doing business. And when things go badly, they need to be relieved of these debts, and they can come into the local courthouse and apply for insolvency like any white debtor might. And many, many, many do across the decades. That might be interesting enough, but inside those proceedings, I discovered that free men of color were being appointed by the court to serve as trustees in these proceedings. Now, to a lay audience, this might not be as clear as it might be, but the lawyer in me knows that what a trustee is someone who is, in essence, stands in the shoes of the court, is given over the authority of the court to collect debts, to assess the debtor's obligations, and ultimately to collect and redistribute the assets among those who are owed. This is a tremendous responsibility. Even today, we understand trustees as people holding a very special place in the life of a court. And I was surprised to find free men of color exercising this kind of responsibility, court-sanctioned responsibility, which said to me, a judge is making the call that this is someone who not only has the individual capacity, but has the kind of standing in the courthouse and in the community to stand basically in the shoes of a judge and help the court to do its business.
This really surprised you.
This surprised me.
Yeah, it does make me wonder who these judges were.
Yeah, well,
I'm still fixed on that question.
Yeah.
I wonder whether there was a chief judge who sent the message to everybody else. I mean, I'm sure these, as you said, in the case of the chief judge of the Maryland Court of Appeals, he was not a racially egalitarian. It's hard to imagine any white man of the power class being like that, unless they were an avowed abolitionist. But for those on the bench to go along with all of this, you know,
well,
recognize that black people had rights?
Yeah, I think it's a reminder that in a state like Maryland, laws are being written in Annapolis. And Annapolis is a place that is contending with sort of Baltimore-oriented and based folks who are working in a world where slavery is falling away in its everyday significance in their lives. And they are confronting folks from the Eastern Shore, from Southern Maryland. And the laws reflect the compromises and the aspirations, but mostly the compromises of that really complicated political scene in Annapolis. It helps us appreciate how much discretion is a part of the everyday administration of law. And there's nothing, for example, in the insolvency statute out of Annapolis that says only white men can do X or only white men can do Y. And so if you're a judge in Baltimore and
you don't see that language
and it seems efficient to you or
right.
appropriate to you,
right.
you can use your discretion to extend to free men of color that sort of privilege in the courthouse. So it was important to me to tell a local story, to stay focused on Baltimore, because that was the way I could capture not only the formal rules that were coming from Annapolis, but what are people doing with those rules? How are they bending and stretching and just interpreting those rules? And we all know that, because who among us hasn't negotiated with, you know, somebody writing a parking ticket, right? And you realize there's a discretion, right, in the everyday administration of law. And sometimes you get lucky and you persuade someone to let you out of that ticket, and sometimes you don't. And that is true in the everyday life of law. And that is the kind of intelligence I think that people of color have in Baltimore and develop in Baltimore, is the kind of intelligence that lets them know who's the judge who's receptive to this, which of the clerk's offices are open to this. And they use
they get savvy to that.
Right? And and Annapolis may never know, right? Annapolis may never know how the rules are being interpreted. But that was the story I wanted to capture.
It really was a crucible, wasn't it?
Yeah, it really was, because these are the questions that are going to confront every slaveholding locality in the country immediately after slavery. And in Baltimore, we can watch that unfold in kind of slow motion.
Over a 30 or 40 year period.
Absolutely. Yeah. And it tells us a lot about how, by the time we get to Reconstruction, free people of color know a whole lot about a whole lot of things. And for those who have in earlier histories doubted their capacities, part of what I would say is, well, you could only doubt their capacities if you failed to study what they had been doing in the years leading up to the Civil War.
Thank you very much.
Thanks very much.
Martha Jones is the Society of Black Alumni Presidential Professor and a professor of history at Johns Hopkins University. Her book is Birthright Citizens, A History of Race and Rights in Antebellum America. It is published by Cambridge University Press. And that's our show for now. Your thoughts are welcome by email, Twitter, or on Facebook. Please tell your friends about the podcast. And if you get a chance, review our show on iTunes, your Apple Podcast app, or for Android users on Stitcher. For producer Steve Early in the Baltimore Sun Newsroom, I'm Dan Rodericks. Thanks for listening to Roughly Speaking, and we'll see you again soon.